Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies.
As we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind.
From Ken Adam to Max Zorin, with occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. We'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. If you want to support the podcast, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondAtoZ, and you can find the link in the show notes. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where N is for Never Say Never Again, the 1983 James Bond film starring Sean Connery in his final movie outing as 007. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we take a look at the second Bond film not produced by Eon is the man I will put in my memoirs as number one. It's Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello.
And making his final-ish outing on the podcast before we send him off to the health clinic to get rid of his free radicals, it's Mr. Tom Wheatley.
Hello there.
This is a big one, guys. We've teased it many, many times, but we're finally going to cover the 54-year saga of Kevin McClory, who I would say is the biggest enemy the Bond movies ever faced throughout its history. It's the big one, right?
Certainly the culmination of a very, very long and interesting series of events.
It's got to be the biggest behind-the-scenes stories about the making of the film, and it basically casts a shadow over the movies. From the day that Thunderball was published, right up until the release of Spectre in 2015. So it's a big, big, long story, the saga behind Never Say Never Again.
Mm. But huge repercussions.
Huge repercussions, yeah. But I just wanted to, before we dive into it, I wanted to just sort of mention something that it's easy to forget, is that it was a big deal, Sean Connery coming back at this point to James Bond. It had been a while since he'd been, 11 years since he'd been in Diamonds Are Forever, 12 years. And it was, at the time, you know, it was a huge deal. There's no parallels to it in pop culture, I don't think, where, you know, you've got the ability to make another film with the same characters and the same actor, but it not be linked to the other ones. It's an interesting case. But Roger Ebert at the time said there will. It was showbiz miracles that never happened. There was never a Beatles reunion. Bob Dylan and Joan Baez didn't appear on the same stage anymore. But here, by God, is Sean Connery as Sir James Bond. Good work, 007. So, yeah, thought that was interesting. Before we dive into the making of, thought we'd just do a quick synopsis. So an aging James Bond makes an uncharacteristic mistake during a routine training mission, leading M to believe that the legendary British spy is now past his prime. M suspends Bond from active duty. However, when Spectre member Fatima Blush and her fellow terrorists successfully steal two nuclear missiles from the US military, M must reinstate Bond as he is the only agent who can beat Spectre at their own game of espionage. So yes, worth mentioning, this is a remake of Thunderball, the 1965 James Bond film. So why don't we kick off there and sort of talk about how Kevin McClory got involved with Thunderball in the first place?
Well, take it all the way back to 1958, when Ian Fleming was working with independent film producer Kevin McClory and scriptwriter Jack Whittingham on a potential Bond film. And the title for this was Longitude 78 West. What do you think of that title?
Dreadful.
Yeah. I think if they released one now, it's quite clunky. I look down.
I like it.
Do you? Of course you do.
Yeah. Interesting. Sparks some ideas in my head of what it could be about.
Yeah. Well, do you know any of the countries that fall through Longitude 78 West on the map?
I haven't got a clue. I'd love to know. I'd love to watch the film and find out.
Well, you can't. No, but shame, Jamaica is one of them.
Right.
I'm sure they'll make it at some point.
So, yeah, it was originally planned to be produced by Xanadu Productions, and this was a company set up by Ian Fleming, Kevin McClory, Jack Whittingham, and Ernie Cuneo. But they struggled to get the funding, and then the producers, Ernie Cuneo and Ivor Bryce, they pulled out of the production. So, even though it's unproduced, the story from the script then went on to be used by Ian Fleming in his book Thunderball. And this is where the problems begin, because he didn't credit either of the other two that helped him, either McClory or Whittingham. And then I think we covered in the Doctor No episode that Thunderball was intended to be the first Eon James Bond film, but due to these ongoing issues that would stem from that novel that Fleming wrote, that wasn't the case. And the script of Longitude 78 West was actually sold at auction for €11,000 in 2013. So it's still out there.
Interesting that Fleming turned it into a book. He'd because he had done that before. I'm just trying to think. It was Moonraker, one we covered recently, that had started out an idea for as a script, hadn't it? And he just turned it into a book. So I imagine he didn't really think he was doing anything too out of the ordinary when he wrote Thunderball.
Well, the difference is he wrote the Moonraker screenplay, didn't he?
Yeah.
On his own. So I think it all does stem from the fact he wasn't acknowledging the other two writers.
Yeah.
But who is Kevin McClory?
Good question. It's actually quite an interesting one, because Kevin McClory is one of these people that's so intrinsically linked to the Bond series, but I think most people that probably hear about him know very little about who he actually was. He's basically famous because of Thunderball and legal battles about Thunderball, which doesn't really give you much information on who he actually was running up to that point. He was fairly prolific and he did a lot of stuff in his early years. He was a screenwriter, Irish screenwriter, producer, he was a director. And apparently his ancestry goes back to the Brontes, I found out, which is interesting.
Interesting.
He was obviously was in the Second World War, as everyone who was in the earlier Bond films was involved. He was a radio officer, and he actually saw a few attacks by German U-boats, so saw some action in the war. His film career began around, he's working at Shepton Studios, and he was a boom operator. He worked with Warwick Films on the Cockleshell Heroes, so already he's started to get that link into the Bond world. He's done some quite amazing stuff, really. He was an assistant to John Huston on The African Queen and Moulin Rouge. He worked on Moby Dick as assistant director for Huston, and then worked on Around the World in 80 Days in 1956 as a second unit director and associate producer. So he's worked on some pretty cool stuff. Apparently he was also romantically involved with Liz Taylor, and that caused some issues because she was in a relationship with somebody else, and there was a few issues along the way with that. So there were some Hollywood stories that covered that. And also, he led an expedition of 25 chaps to drive around the world. And there was a documentary called One Road, which covers that attempt. And it was Ford. It was a Ford-supported expedition, so he did a lot of adverts and stuff for them. So at that time, he was pretty famous. He was a pretty big deal. He's just, this stuff hasn't really stood the test of time from what we know from him now. Obviously, getting involved in the film world, he was worked with Ian Fleming on the Thunderball script, the original Thunderball script.
Yeah, I think he was working on a film called The Boy in the Bridge, and that was
that's right, yeah.
that was the film that was that it sort of linked them together. I think it was Ivor Bryce had introduced them, and it was because that he had directed this film. It felt like Ian Fleming felt like this was a guy who could make films, who could get these things done, and that's how he was brought in. But from what I understand, he was quite a famous, like you say, quite a famous society guy at the time, just as famous as Fleming and what have you, always in the newspapers. And he apparently, I learned that he roomed with Guy Hamilton as well at one point.
Really?
So yeah, he knew a lot of different people. But yeah, that's how he got involved. So yeah, like I said, I mean, when Fleming went to write the book Thunderball, he'd done turning scripts and other ideas into books before on Moonraker and Free Our Eyes Only. So he probably didn't think he was doing that much harm. And so Thunderball was written and was slated for release in March 1961. But Kevin McClory somehow got sent a copy of the book. Didn't know that it was related to the scripts that he'd been working on at the time. But realised what was happening and basically contacted his lawyer, this guy called Peter Carter Ruck, who then tried to take an injunction out to stop the book from being published. So they took Fleming and the publisher Jonathan Cape to court. But this attempt at putting an injunction on the book was thrown out because the defence hadn't been given enough time to stop the publication. It was very much it was printed and ready to go to the shops. So the judge said that the book should be published. So after that, in 1963, after the release of Dr. No and From Russia with Love had happened, the case of Kevin McClory and Jack Whittingham suing Ian Fleming for plagiarism ended up going to court. Jack Whittingham pulled out not long after it started because of the finance, the cost of taking someone to court over these sorts of things. So it's interesting, really, that this sort of thing really should never have gone to court. This is the sort of thing that happens quite a lot, and they should have settled it out of court. But Ivor Bryce was bankrolling Ian Fleming, and Kevin McClory's rich family and his wife were bankrolling him. He could sense that there was money to be made here, and so he decided to take it all the way. And it was a decision that would cost Ian Fleming dearly. McClory, by the time it had gone to court or was going to court, he was already talking about making a rival James Bond film at this stage, and he even knew Sean Connery and, you know, had conversations about maybe tempting him away. But so the trial then took place at the High Court in London in November 1963. It was very highly talked about in the press, went on for 9 days. But in the end, Kevin McClory and Fleming decided to settle. So this happened very, very last minute, apparently. They were in the ninth day of the hearing, and all of a sudden the case stopped. The judge said that they wanted to meet either side together. And this is from Andrew Lycett's book about Ian Fleming. He said, 14 people, counting the lawyers, were crammed like school children into a smallish room with no table, only chairs set in a circle around the edge. In less than 10 minutes, they had agreed in principle to come to terms, the details of which were thrashed out later. So the details of the settlement were that Ian Fleming could retain the rights to the books as long as he gave McClory and Whittingham credit within the book, so based on ideas from these two guys, and then McClory would then get the film and television rights to Thunderball. McClory is also awarded £35,000 plus court costs. As to why they settled, it's not really very clear, but there was mounting costs involved. And Cubby and Harry, in fact, had even got involved at this stage, and they had offered to underwrite the costs of continuing the case for a further fortnight. They were obviously wanted to keep the Bond rights out of someone else's hands, but obviously that didn't happen. So there were 10 scripts in all that Kevin McClory then claimed ownership of. And it was during this trial that Fleming had a couple of heart attacks. And he later died then in 1964. So Richard Maybaum had written a script for Thunderball in 1961, but they couldn't make it because of the legal dispute, as mentioned. And then after that, the idea that McClory was exploring was to make Thunderball with Richard Burton. So that was what he was hoping to do. But that didn't happen. In the end, they came to an agreement in 1965. to produce Thunderball together. And we'll do more on Thunderball when we get to that letter. But part of that agreement was that Kevin McClory would agree to not remake it for at least 10 years after the first domestic release of Thunderball, which was in January 1966. And it's interesting that Cubby and Harry agreed to this because it seemed, must have seemed fairly low risk to them at the time. I mean, the franchise had never gone on that long before. So they thought that, you know, by that stage, they wouldn't be making James Bond films anymore. So, but McClory thought that there would still be interest in Bond by that stage. So in 1976, McClory exercised his rights to remake Thunderball as he was legally allowed to in the agreement that he had made with Ian Fleming back in court in 1963. So, I mean, it's worth saying at this point that Never Say Never Again is, they people say it's unofficial, but it is official. They had the rights to make it. All legal rights he had to make this film. So it's just not considered canon in the Eon canon.
Yeah, it's amazing that he had the foresight that to see that the franchise would be carrying on then. You know, you would have thought with the success of the first couple of films, they would have thought, well, there's a chance this might go on longer than 10 years.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, so that deal went through. He then has the rights. The rights are in his hands again. And he embarks on creating another film, this time with the title James Bond of the Secret Service. This was McClory getting back into the Bond game, as you put it. And I've got here as well that he wanted Richard Attenborough to direct and he wanted Richard Burton as Bond. So I assume he just still wanted Richard Burton from before.
Yeah, must have done. I think he was someone that he was definitely interested in getting to play at.
Yeah, and he wanted Orson Welles as Blofeld as well. But in what was an amazing development, Sean Connery was brought on board to come and help write the script. So obviously by this point, Connery's been gone for 4 or 5 years from the franchise. He's got Len Dayton, who he wrote the Ipcress file. He got him on board. He was a big fan of his writing. He said, well, Len was an obvious choice. One other Bond novel had been written by Kingsley Amis, but I don't think that worked quite well. He's a good writer, but Len Dayton, I've always liked as a thriller writer. And then he got him on board, and he said to Len, I'd like to bring Sean in, because he wanted the humour that Connery can deliver. Interesting, because he'd never written anything before, so they decided to bring him on board. But apparently it worked in terms of them working together. He went and had a word with Sean, said, do you want to come write with us? He said, yeah. And they made an arrangement. So they were just working in Ireland or Marbella. They'd go all over and they'd just write together. So in terms of the actual script they came up with, it involves weaponized robotic sharks.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Normal.
Yeah, really normal. And then obviously at the end, you see Bond, he's battling one of the robot sharks in a sewer in Manhattan. I mean, does that sound Bondian at all?
Sounds very Never Say Never Again.
That's James Bond Jr.
Yeah. Connery, at this point, he didn't think he would play a part in terms of acting in it. And he said in an interview, when I first worked on the script with Len, I had no thought of actually being in the film. So yeah, with that script in mind, it did take a title change. It went from James Bond of the Secret Service and changed to Warhead. And that was because of the similarities between On Her Majesty's Secret Service. They wanted to sort of step away from that.
It's interesting that Sean Connery saying he doesn't have an interest in acting in it. But surely the reason that Connery's brought on is because that's the key to getting the film made.
Mm.
Is Connery's involvement, because really there's no way of getting this movie made without having Sean Connery on board. No one's going to touch it. No one's going to invest their money in it without Sean Connery, because why would you pay to have a Richard Burton Bond film made?
Yeah.
And Connery's there. He's right there. Well,
yeah. And written by Connery. That'd be weird, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. They definitely, they weren't just using him to say he's a writer on it. They probably just said, oh, Sean Connery is involved.
Involved.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
But I mean,
writing. Right. Okay.
A lot of his one-liners are in the early films, didn't he? Mm. So, but yeah, it takes more than one-liners. To
Can't get a man on for one-liners, though.
No.
I read some interesting stuff about that script. I think apparently it was quite, and you can kind of get the idea from it, that it's quite Austin Powers style. It's quite spoofy. And Austin Powers almost covers the same things as that script does, like the robot sharks and stuff. It's almost a parody of Never Say Never Again, or well, the Warhead script originally. But yeah, eventually. Oh, yeah, and they had some weird character names in it. They had a female character called Justin Loves It, which I think has in the script. It's got John Bond says, "Oh, does she?" Wasn't Roger Moore? I don't know why I did it as Roger Moore. But yeah, bit of a mess. But at the same time, Eon were about to make Spy Who Loved Me, which is obviously heavily set underwater, and there were certain links between the two films. So obviously, you can't two Bond films being made at the same time that are heavily focused on water-based activity. It sparks up a few ruffles a few feathers, if you will. So that caused a few problems in the making of it. So Paramount were they took on the project, and they were going to make it. They were, you know, they got Sean Connery people involved. It was going to happen. But partly because of this Spy Who Loved Me stuff as well, things started to get a little bit messy. And it was really McClory who kicked it off. He didn't want them to make the Spy Who Loved Me while he was making this, because he felt like the Spy Who Loved Me was almost copying what he was doing because of all this underwater stuff. So he actually took out an injunction against Eon at the time. But apparently Eon had also taken out an injunction against Warhead as well. So it was getting quite messy. And they were both claiming that each other had stolen the material from them. So because of that, there was this legal battle going on, and Connery and Paramount just pulled out of it because they just didn't want to be involved in this legal battle. So obviously Spy Who Loved Me went ahead, and then that was the end of Warhead, or the start of the end of Warhead.
Yeah, interesting as well that I learned that both McClory and Cubby Broccoli had been to this expo where they'd seen this thing called Aquapolis, which was this underwater city, and that's why they were both working towards this idea of having an underwater city in it. And that's why...
Aquapolis.
Aquapolis, yeah.
That sounds awful.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's just... it's all this litigation. There's no studio is going to back this movie. And so, yeah. And I think at this point also Connery starts to back off a little bit as well.
Yeah. You've got to imagine that this isn't the first time this has happened. So they're probably looking at this going, oh, God, no, not again.
Yeah.
Like, we took a chance on this and then... We can't go like that. That went. There was probably in the newspapers for about 2 years, wasn't it? The whole Thunderball stuff.
Yeah.
So looking back on that, going, we can't get involved in this. It's just not worth it.
So yeah, no studio would touch it due to the litigation. But the film found an unlikely hero in the shape of a guy called Jack Schwartzman, who is an entertainment lawyer. He later married Francis Ford Coppola's sister, Talia Shire, and he's the father of Jason Schwartzman, the actor. So I thought that was quite interesting. Anyway, he was the executive at a company that turned down Warhead, but he could see a way. So somehow he could see his way through the legal issues. He could see a way to make the movie with Kevin McClory. So he left his job at the film company and went and set up Talia Film. And he met with Kevin McClory and they agreed a deal to option the rights in 1981. So one of the many legal blockers that the film was facing was that McClory's previous versions, James Bond and the Secret Service, Warhead, they just deviated so far from the original Thunderball scripts that the argument was that they're making a sequel. They're not remaking what the rights, the stuff that they've got the rights to. So the decision was made to go back to basics and remake Thunderball as they had the rights to do. So Schwartzman became the producer and he was developing a screenplay and then at the same time raising funds. And he managed to raise $30 million from banks and distributors around the world including Warner Brothers, who would act as the general distributor to the film. And he said that he'd gone to lots of different places because he felt that the legal issues wouldn't, they wouldn't be able to go after every single person who'd invested money in it. They, by spreading the money out, that they felt that they were on safer ground that way. So that's quite an interesting way of doing it. McClory claims to have offered Cubby Broccoli the chance to present the film as they had done with Thunderball, but apparently he turned it down. Danjak and Eon apparently wished him well, and he said they also said that if I went outside my rights, they would do everything in their power to protect themselves. So there was a guy at Warner Brothers was retained as executive consultant, a guy called John Calley, and he'll come up later in the story. But they left the Dayton Connery script behind and hired someone called Julian Plowden to write the screenplay. And then Lorenzo Semple Jr. was hired. Does that name ring a bell?
Very much so.
He'd written or had worked on the script for 1967's Casino Royale. And it was his decision to make Bond play his age, and Connery at the time was 52. Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet also were brought on to do rewrites. They were hired just to do a week, 10 days, but they ended up staying on the whole production. It was their idea to do the pre-title sequence as a training scene, because apparently in the original script, the pre-title sequence was set in a medieval jousting tournament. And Bond was only revealed at the end when he lifted up his helmet and was revealed to be Bond. But I mean, that's just one of the worst ideas I've ever heard. Clement and Lefrenet stayed on the film then throughout. They actually just were kept on board to keep things going. And they were the ones that also brought in Rowan Atkinson's character as well. But Lorenzo Semple Jr. is the sole writing credit on the movie. It's finally coming together. They've got a script and they've got the funding. They just need the cast now.
Indeed. So to get Connery back on board to play Bond. Right. So I've got a couple of figures here. It's either $3 million or $5 million. He had casting approval, script approval, and 15% share of the profits. So, you know, It's a huge deal, but it would need to be to get Connery back. Why would Connery come back and do this? Well, there are many reasons. He's gone on record to say, he said it's really dense in terms of the story, the subplot and texture. It's like a detective story, and I have to take quite a bit of responsibility for that. So very, very much leaning on that script approval he's got, he's able to give input on what sort of film he wants to make. And he also said, because I insisted that they go back to that sort of movie if we're going to do it, which I suppose is a certain kind of nostalgia on my part. So again, he's tapping into, you know, his youth, you know, the role that made him who he is. He said to say no to all wasn't that difficult to me because I wanted to do different things. To say yes to Never Say Never Again wasn't as definite. It came out of a series of situations. My wife had said, why don't you do it again? I thought about it and it didn't seem like such a crazy idea. So obviously he's been involved in the previous project, James Bond of the Secret Service. So, you know, he's sort of, it makes sense for him to finish the project. But also, did he do it to get revenge on Eon? You know, because he feels like he was... Go back to the Sean Connery episode. But he always felt like he was cheated out of being involved in a bigger way on the Eon films, didn't he? You know, he wanted to be a producer. He wanted to wanted his name on the films more than they were. So eventually that led to him walking away. So yeah, he's back playing James Bond. The main villain in the film, who is Maximilian Largo, was suggested by Connery. So part of Connery's deal was getting the talent on board. So he suggested Klaus Maria Brandauer. He'd seen him in a Hungarian film, Mephisto, and just wanted him on board. Max von Sydow as Ernst Stavro Blofeld. See Blofeld episode for more. Irvin Kershner, he he picked Barbara Carrera to play Fatima Blush. And the name, that the character name, is actually from one of the early scripts of Thunderball. But I have to say, I think she is fantastic.
She's the best thing in the movie, yeah, by a long shot.
The scene where she's coming down the stairs, do you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of Jack Nicholson's Joker. It just had a bit of that sort of... She's having a lot of fun with that role.
And the costumes as well.
The costumes are excellent, yeah. Well, her performance actually earned her a Golden Globe nomination for Best Supporting Actress.
Wow.
Yeah. Sean's wife, Micheline, she met Kim Basinger at a hotel in London and just suggested, you know, why not use her? So she plays Domino in what is her, I think it's her first role, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be.
It's a very early role.
Yeah.
Yeah. Felix Leiter, we covered Bernie Casey, didn't we, in the Leiter episode? I think we,
Yeah.
Yeah, Connery wanted a lighter that was memorable because he said that all the previous lighters weren't memorable. Other cast, so we've got, as you said, Rowan Atkinson was added in, playing Nigel Small Fawcett in what is essentially a precursor to Johnny English, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it could be a young Johnny English.
He also play that same character in Hot Shots 1 or 2, Part 2.
God, that is good knowledge. Yeah, he does, doesn't he?
It's just one of his three characters, isn't it, that he can play?
Well, I don't know why he's got a speech impediment. It doesn't add anything.
It's a very, very large performance, isn't it?
Mm, it is, yeah. Especially when Connery tells him to use the natural cover and he does that ridiculous Mr. Bean. He's basically playing Mr. Bean at that point, hiding behind the pillars. Edward Fox plays M, as we covered in the M episode. Slightly different way of playing it to Bernard Lee's version that we saw. And they really lean heavily on how many cuts have been made, don't they? There's a lot of nods to the finances.
Yes, yeah.
Which again follows through with Q, who is called Algernon, played by Alec McCowan. Very different to Desmond Llewellyn's portrayal. He says he hopes there'll be plenty of gratuitous sex and violence in what I think is a nod to the official Eon Bond films.
Yes. I you know what I really like about the Q scene in this one is Q's lab feels very real.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like it's a working lab. You can see he's actually doing stuff.
Yeah, it feels like a working environment, whereas the other ones just look like sound stages, don't they? But
what are you talking about? What about the one in A Spy Loved Me, where it's in a pyramid or something?
I actually like the relationship between this Q and Bond as well. Like, he just really likes him, and it's just a friendly at work conversation.
Yes.
So yeah, that's the cast.
Crew's a tricky one on this one, because normally when we do these specials, when we're talking about the films, there's a lot of crossover. So you say, oh, here's so-and-so, obviously he was involved in directing this one. And you can sort of form these links, why they've chosen that person for the film and why the film is the way it is. But obviously the crew in this one is all new. So you've mentioned quite a few of them already. So obviously the director, Irving Kirshner, there's not many films he's famous in, but there's a big link between a lot of the crew that worked on this film. So the main films that he worked on were Empire Strikes Back, Never Say Never Again, obviously, and RoboCop 2.
Right.
So you can see there, Empire Strikes Back is a pretty big one to be involved with. We've already mentioned Jack Whittingham and Lorenzo Semple Jr. And also, you mentioned Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenaise as well. So, you ticked off a lot of these. Obviously, McClure is producer and Schwartzman was a producer as well. Schwartzman, I don't know how much you know about Schwartzman, but he two films that he's most famous for working on are Where the Heart Is and Field of Dreams.
Interesting.
That's quite interesting. There's a couple of other people that are probably worth mentioning. One is Vic Armstrong's back. He's stunt coordinator on Never Say Never Again. So there's finally an actual Bond link.
Yes.
T- to this film, so they managed to get him involved. I imagine it's probably easier to get a stunt coordinator than get somebody who's sort of creatively associated with it. It's probably quite hard to get some of the Bond stalwarts to be involved.
I think they did try, but a lot of them felt it would.
They did try to get
Peter Hunt, I think, to direct at one point.
Yeah.
But Vic Armstrong, they managed to get, probably because he's more of a
technical
guy, so it's not really as big, and it doesn't really affect him that much. He's just for hire, really. And another guy who was involved is the second unit director. That was Roy Button. Now, Roy Button is, he's done a lot of films, but he did all of the Star Wars films, I think. Yeah, Return of the Jedi, Empire Strikes Back. Might not have done the first one. But he also did Superman and Rage of the Lost Ark, Gandhi. Loads of, you can see the link there. There's some big stuff. Superman 2. So apart from those guys, there's not really anyone worth mentioning, because they're all sort of secondary ones that don't really have any relationship to the Bond films. But that's the crew that they amassed for the film.
Yeah, so in a break from what we know from other Bond films, this one was shot at Elstree Studios, and so that's where pre-production was done for this movie. And it began shooting in the south of France on the 27th of September 1982, and they filmed Sean Connery in a casino. So a great way for him to come back, I guess. Also in the south of France, they shot the motorbike chase and the interiors for Largo's Middle Eastern home, Palmyra. Interestingly, this film was mired with issues behind the scenes. Now, the list is endless, apparently Irving Kirshner was difficult to work with and would often like to improvise, and he'd improvise whole action scenes and sequences that would require great setups, and was just very, very difficult to pin him down. Apparently the script was a total mess and was constantly changing as well. That's why you've got Clement and Frenet on set. You've got Connery, who was basically just furious with everything. I think he felt that when he finally got to shoot this film that he'd been waiting so long to do, and had so many promises made to him, felt like he'd been let down on nearly everything. And so he was just really, really upset with Schwartzman in particular. And Schwartzman in turn was absolutely terrified of Sean Connery, and they didn't like to be in the same room together. It was just a total nightmare. And I think Connery saw Kirshner as a bit of an amateur as well. So there was a lot of tension on set. Other locations, so for legal reasons, they kept most of the action in the Bahamas. And that was so that, you know, it could be argued that it was a remake and not a sequel, which was part of the issue. And the production moved there in November 1982. The second unit had already been there shooting their underwater stuff. But apparently they'd been there for quite a while, but when they arrived and looked at a lot of the dailies for the underwater sequences, they basically decided that the double that they'd used for Sean Connery was completely unconvincing. Apparently he's a really skinny, like weedy guy, and looked nothing like this 6'2" Sean Connery. So they had to scrap a lot of footage, and it all had to be reshot. Then after the Bahamas, they went back to Elstree to shoot on sound stages. There was some location work at Waddesdon Manor in Buckinghamshire, that's the casino, and also Luton Hoo, which stood in for Shrublands, which is just down the road from me, so I might have to pay that a visit. Connery later returned to the Bahamas to shoot additional material, and there was second unit work which was also being done in Spain, and that's the stuff that Vic Armstrong shot with the horse jumping off the castle wall, which is quite an alarming stunt, I think, but I'm sure you'll talk about a bit more about that now.
Yeah, so in terms of, and this is a problem, I don't know if you two have encountered this, finding details that we're used to on the Eon-produced Bond films is way easier. This was quite difficult, and so I'm going to give a shout-out to another podcast, actually, in terms of the stunts on this film. So it is a podcast called Behind the Stunts, and they covered Never Say Never Again in great detail. So I would recommend... if you're really interested, I'm going to give a brief overview, but if you're really interested, go and listen to their episode of that. But so Vic Armstrong was stunt coordinator, and that horse the horse stunt. Quite amazing how they did it, really, because I've always thought and watched it and go, there's no way they did that. There's no way the horse, they've thrown a horse into water. Ridiculous. But they did. The horse was actually trained over months to be able to, like, they started gradually and then they make it higher and higher. Because when the film was released, it got a lot of backlash from RSPCA and a lot of animal welfare organisations. They were concerned about the horse. But it was done in complete safety. The horse was fully trained. The American Humane Association were present there. But there's a clip on YouTube, but courtesy of Behind the Stunts, if you have a look at that. And they used like a guide point. It's like a chute where they shoot straight into the water and then the camera is above it to get that. But yeah, the horse goes into the water and just swims off, and it had been trained to do that. In terms of other stunts, I mean, there's not that, the stunts are few and far between, to be honest, in this. Not like the Bond films we're used to. The bike chase is a standout point, though, and that was actually shot with a camera on the helmet of the person on the bike. It's quite a good stunt. It reminded me of a bit of No Time to Die in Matera, the start of that.
Hmm.
Be interesting if they did take any pointers from Never Say Never Again. Another stunt. So Rocky Taylor he got a Guinness World Record, actually, because he doubled for two Bonds in the same year. So yeah. He doubled for Roger Moore in Octopussy and then Connery in Never Say Never Again. And I think that's, you know, you referenced the stuntman that was too skinny to play Connery.
Yeah.
I think this is where they brought Rocky Taylor on board. I think that's why. Because he's got a bigger frame. And also, so Connery was doing some training for the fight scenes, and he got Steven Seagal on board.
Yes.
To help him brush up on his skills. So I didn't know that Sean Connery was already, he was a black belt in karate. Did you know that?
No.
So, yeah, he said, I got a hold of Stephen and we had this training in the building where I had an apartment, and he was really very good and everything. And I got a little cocky because I thought I knew what I was doing, because the principle is it's defence. So it's a pyramid, and I got a bit flash. So he got flash, and then he went to the doctors in 1995. Bear in mind, this is 1983. And it was discovered that he'd broken his wrist.
Oh, God.
But... so he'd been walking around for 12 years with a broken wrist.
Oh. Because of Steven Seagal?
Because of Steven Seagal, yes.
God, I'd love to have seen that fight.
But yeah, I there's not many other standout stunt that's to me. Is there any that I've missed? They're the big ones, aren't they?
They're the big ones, yeah.
Coffee? Medium sweet. Two, medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a Ko-fi page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA to Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
Well, moving on to the music, we talked a little bit about them trying to get hold of the big names. So they did try and get John Barry to join in, but he was obviously very loyal to Eon, so said no. Obviously, it's probably a big risk for somebody like Barry to get involved, because obviously it's so intrinsic to the Bond style. I think it would have massively helped if they did have John Barry to do the sound, but obviously they couldn't get that. They also tried to get James Horner. He was apparently the first choice to do the music, because the producers were impressed with Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan that he'd done.
Interesting.
Yeah, but he was unavailable, and they apparently, Schwartzman said that Sean Connery vetoed him, didn't want him to do it. So eventually it was written by Michael Legrand, who it's an interesting score.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah, and apparently he used to be a jazz pianist, so there's a lot of jazz stylings to it, which don't necessarily work or seem a bit weird in a lot of cases. People said that the soundtrack was anachronistic and misjudged, bizarrely intermittent, and the most disappointing feature of the film. Probably quite accurate there in some areas. It definitely, I think, if there's any area of the film that jars, it's the music, because you know, this, we talk about how there's certain things that you need in a Bond film to make it work and for consistency, and one of those is the consistent music that you get with Bond films. You always have the same sort of musical cues that come at the right times. There's certain songs that play. It doesn't have any of those, and you're kind of expecting it at some points and it doesn't happen. I'm sure somebody has edited it and put on,
there's loads, yeah.
Yeah.
There's loads you can watch with the Bond theme on it.
Yes, I remember a friend of ours did that with the new A Team, because that doesn't have the A Team music on most of the films that we put that on. So yeah, the main song was written by Legrand, "Never Say Never Again," had lyrics by Alan and Marilyn Bergman, and it was performed by Lani Hall. But Lani Hall wasn't the first choice. They did actually want Bonnie Tyler to do it, but she declined because she didn't like the song. There was another song made by Phyllis Hyman, who recorded a song, but that never passed the test. So they ended up with a Lani Hall version. But yeah, I think the song itself, it's all right. It's a bit sort of flat, isn't it? Not really much to it. Doesn't really have any heart to it. Doesn't really build up into any way. It's a little bit melodious. But I would agree with that assumption that the music is probably one of, if not the most disappointing parts of the film, that really does cause a problem when you're watching it. It just shows, instantly makes you think this isn't a Bond film.
But it also doesn't make you think this is an action film. It's just so weak. The music in this film just never.
It's not comedic even. It's nothing. It just sort of plods along and is backing music.
And it's it doesn't even try to do a John Barry, like an homage or anything.
No.
I imagine that there's a lot of things in this film that try and move away from the Eon style. You look at some of the characters like M and some of the other people in it, and they're obviously trying to distance themselves a bit from the Eon style. But the music, you can't. Like, if that's what they were trying to do, it's a stupid idea, because you can't stop change the music, because instantly, like, the action scene music is just so slow and boring.
It's so lame.
I think that the song gets lost, and because it's not on a Maurice Binder titles, it gets lost, completely lost. So not only fair enough, we've got average Bond songs in the Eon films, but you've got the titles to sort of support it.
I think the Never Say Never Again theme tune is like somebody trying to sing a Bond song, like your mum singing a Bond song, who can't quite remember how it goes, and just repeats the same line over again, and it's just nonsense. But that's it. They just say "Never Say Never Again" over and over again in different ways. It's just awful.
So, yeah, I mean, let's talk about the film itself. What do you think of Never Say Never Again? How do you think it compares to Thunderball?
I mean, it's a bad. If you're viewing it from the point of view of a film, not associating it with Bond, just going, is it a good film? I think there's some redeemable qualities. I like Connery. I like the angle they've taken with Connery. I think it's the right angle. I think Connery's quite likeable in it. He's got a few scenes where you go, oh, that's quite nice. It's a nod to the fact that he's older. It's a nod to the fact that he was Bond. So I think there's some nice elements to that. So I think when you judge it on sort of an objective way and watch it from the point of view that this guy used to be Bond, it's sort of a nice nod. If you didn't know anything about Bond and you watched that film, it's a bad film. It's like bad actors in it. There's no chemistry between a lot of the people. It just, a lot of it doesn't work and it falls flat. It just goes on for a long time and there's not a lot to it.
Oh, you dodged the question. Nice.
What was the question?
Thunderball.
How do you think it compares to Thunderball?
I like Thunderball.
Right, again, you've dodged the question.
I think it's far inferior to Thunderball.
Yes.
Just because it's not a Bond film. I don't think it can be classed as a Bond film from the context of it. And it, yeah, I still think Thunderball is a good film from the point of view that it's got some nice elements to it. It's fun. I don't think this film's fun.
I don't like Thunderball. I prefer this.
I think we all know that.
Yeah, I prefer this. However, I just don't think the story, regardless if it's this or Thunderball, is that interesting. I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, it falls flat, doesn't it? A lot of the stuff, like this, they're just stupid things. Like the bit with they have the computer game fight.
Painful.
There's literally no. It's what he's going to get electric shock. Who cares?
Yeah, yeah. There's no peril, is there?
There's no peril, and it's just stupid. Mm. It's like even at that time, I imagine people watching that going, "That's pretty rubbish."
There's also a bit
very technologically advanced.
There's a bit in the arcade where they walk through a video game arcade as well, which just to me doesn't seem like something you'd get in a James Bond film. It just doesn't have the glamour.
Well, they're trying to turn it into an 80s film, aren't they? Like, modernise it in an 80s way, but you can't do that. The other 80s Bonds don't modernise it based on culture. It's not about computer games and stuff. It's just set in the 80s, whereas this is drawing attention to...
A View to a Kill. It's about microchips.
Yeah, but there's no computer games with them having a fight with them.
No. What do you like about the film, Brendan?
I echo what Wheatley said about Connery. I like the version of Bond that Connery is playing. I think it's much more genuine than the version he was playing in Diamonds Are Forever. I thought he looked disinterested and tired in Diamonds Are Forever. And I know he had problems on the set of this, but it doesn't come across.
He looks fresh-faced in an older way. Mm. Like, he looks happy. He's got a bit of a... You know, a bit of charm about him, but he's always it's always knowing that he's older.
Yeah,
but he knows that, and that's the beauty of it. Where you compare it to Roger in View to a Kill, who doesn't know he's old.
Yeah, well, I think they handled him being old much better than the Eon ones did with Roger Moore. Actually, yeah,
yeah.
I'll tell you a few things I like. I like Fatima Blush. I think she's great in it, as discussed. I think her costumes seem to have come from a completely different movie. And I will say that the costuming throughout this movie, I think, is pretty poor, except when it comes to Fatima Blush. I think Connery ever really looks the part as Bond in his clothes. There's some weird clothing going on.
Vest and pants? Vest and pants on a bike?
Yeah, and the dungarees. and he wears that jacket towards the end. I just don't really like that. And also, I like Klaus Maria Brandauer as Largo. But he's not as memorable as Thunderball Largo, even though he's a better actor and does a better performance.
He's not scary, is he? He's not a major threat. In fact, the age thing is a problem because they probably worked on the principle, you know, he's young, he's powerful, he's a supervillain, but he just seems like inept in comparison to Connery. Connery's just like looking at him like, what?
And again, the costuming for him doesn't do enough. It just looks so casual. You want a bit of pantomime with your villains. I just don't think you get that with with Largo here. But you do with a little bit with Blofeld. But he's so underused. He might as well not be in it. But I do like
the over makeuping of Connery in some scenes, like when he's taking off that motorcycle helmet.
Yeah.
And he just so much makeup. Early 1980s makeup where they probably didn't quite know how to put makeup on a man who was a bit older. And it just looks a little bit like his sort of boy George.
And the hairpiece is terrible as well. If you thought it was bad in Diamonds Are Forever or You Only Live Twice, I mean, it's like they're like, I don't know, high budget ones compared to this rug that they've put on him in Never Say Never Again. But I think the music's dreadful in it. I quite like the use of the motorbikes. I like that. But it's just a very... One bit that always sticks out to me as being a bit problematic as well is where... I don't know why it happens, but Largo tries to sell Domino to Arabs.
Right.
Do you know which bit I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're like conducting this auction, and then Connery comes in to rescue it. It's just so. I don't really like that bit. But I really like Bernie Casey as Felix Leiter. I think he's great.
What about Bunny Penny?
Pointless. Absolutely pointless.
Very forgettable. Yeah. Free radicals. But I mean, for me, I don't think it's anywhere near as good as Thunderball. I don't mind Thunderball. I think I've got issues with it. I think the final act of Thunderball is too slow. It's too it's too unformed. And by the time we get to Bahamas, it loses all momentum. But
But there's an element of Thunderball which is, and when you watch it when you're younger, it's a really fun film.
Yeah,
it's just a fun film.
Yeah,
this isn't a fun film. This was out when I was a kid, and I at no point ever wanted to watch Never Say Never Again. I imagine at some point my dad had it on in the room, and I just thought, what is this?
Yeah, but his Bond is Connery's Bond. He lacks some of the menace that he had in those early films, and that's what I think is the difference between this and Thunderball. Does some very suspect things in Thunderball, but it's kind of fitting for the era. But in this one, where he does the whole massage thing with Domino, it's just very creepy.
That is very creepy.
Roger Moore doesn't get involved with BB Doll.
No.
Yeah. I don't mind it, but for me, I mean, I know it's an official-ish Bond film. It just doesn't have the elements that I like from a Bond film, and therefore I would choose Thunderball over this any day, I think. Right, let's have a look at what happened to the film when it came out. The world premiere was held on the 6th of October 1983 in LA, and it took $9 to $10 million in its first week, which made it the biggest autumn opening in movie history at that point, and the biggest Bond opening ever. So it was massive, especially in America. Octopussy had opened earlier in the year. In the long run, Octopussy ended up earning more money than it did. Then Never Say Never Again. Octopussy took 187 million. Never Say Never Again took 160 million. So it was a commercial success, but not as big as the official Bond film. Or the Eon Bond film. And there was an option to make a sequel, but Connery at this point just was absolutely sick of it, and it was never acted upon. So talking at the National Film Theatre to promote the film, this is a great quote, by the way, Sean Connery said about the film, "I hate parasites, I hate incompetence. There's nothing I like better than a film that really works, providing you don't have to deal with all the shit that comes afterwards in terms of getting what you're entitled to. But when you get into a situation where somebody who is totally incompetent is in charge, a real ass, then everybody is a struggle. There was so much incompetence, ineptitude and dissension during the making of Never Say Never Again that the film could have disintegrated. What I could have done is just let it bury itself. I could have walked away with an enormous amount of money and the film would never have been finished. But once I was there, I ended up getting in the middle of every decision. The assistant director and myself really produced the picture, so didn't hold back. That's why he's promoting the film as well, by the way.
Didn't hurt though, did it?
No. Roger Ebert gave the film 3.5 stars. He said, "We visit exotic locations, we survive near misses, and Bond spars with the evil woman and redeems the good one. All basic. But what makes Never Say Never Again more fun than most of the Bonds is more complex than that. For one thing, there's the human element in the movie, and that comes from Klaus Maria Brandauer as Largo." The Times, they concentrated on Connery being back as well. They said, "Connery is back looking hardly a day older or thicker and still outclassing every other exponent of the role in the good-natured throwaway with which he parries all the sex and violence on the way." Time Out said, "The action's good, the photography's excellent, the set's decent, but the real clincher is the fact that Bond is once more played by a man with the right stuff. Civilization is safe in the hands of he who has never tasted quiche and who, on the evidence here at least, can perform a very passable tango." So interesting that the mention of quiche there predates A View to a Kill, in which James Bond eats a quiche.
Interesting quiche facts.
Space fact. So, and then just finally, writing in The Observer, Philip French noted that this curiously muted film ends up making no contribution of its own and inviting damaging comparisons with the original hyper-confident Thunderball. So on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got a 70% rating from critics, but just a 37% audience score. So I think it says a lot about the movie.
Yeah, people are idiots. That's what it says. So McClory's done. He's made his remake. Is he finished? Do you think he's finished there? No, he's not. He carries on. So in the late 80s, 1989, he brings back the Warhead script and he changes the name of the project to Atomic Warfare. And this is where he tries to get Pierce Brosnan on board. Brosnan had just missed out on Bond because of the Remington Steele problems with his contract. And he also approaches Timothy Dalton as well. But the project doesn't really get anywhere. It's difficult to get it off the ground. Is this animated?
No, I know. There was talk of an animated version as well, or an animated series.
Because I couldn't find any more about that. But assume it was the same sort of deal. It's the same script anyway, isn't it? And then in the 90s, further plans to adapt the Thunderball story. And this one was called Warhead 2000 AD. Wanted Timothy Dalton to be on board, but also was approached Liam Neeson. He declined it. Yeah, so, still trying to get further remakes made and off the ground. But there were, problems with the rights returned.
Yeah, so you mentioned Warhead 2000. That was the start of discussions with Sony Pictures. And at the time, Sony owned the rights to Casino Royale. So they saw owning the Thunderball rights as an opportunity to really have a bit of oomph when it came to the James Bond universe and almost set up their own MCU, if you will, for Bond. They went through discussions for this, and in fact they in 1997 in October, 2 months prior to the release of Tomorrow Never Dies, they officially announced that the film was going to be released and as a remake of Thunderball, but that was not to happen.
Yeah, Sony was very bullish in its move to set up its own Bond universe, and announcing it before Tomorrow Never Dies was a real dick move on their behalf. And this was led by this guy called John Calley, who we'd mentioned before, had been the executive consultant on Never Say Never Again, and he'd gone to Sony from MGM, and he obviously knew the situation with the Thunderball scripts and what have you, and it would be the downfall of this power play between the two studios. So in February 1998. Kevin McClory launched a lawsuit to prove that he was the co-creator of the cinematic Bond. He was claiming that the movies wouldn't be the same without the work that he had done with Ian Fleming in 1960, whatever, before on the book of Thunderball. He felt that he was instrumental into what we got in the movies. And so that was rumbling on. And then in July 1999, a judge granted MGM an injunction to stop Sony from developing a script for its own Bond film based on the McClory materials. And there were appeals, but an MGM claimed that John Calley had been guilty of sharing proprietary secrets. And it was that part of the situation that ended up being the downfall of Sony's move here. So in March 2000, I think, a settlement was made with Sony declaring itself out of the James Bond business. It compensated MGM with $5 million out of court, and obtained the rights to Casino Royale. Sony, going in the other direction to Sony, were the rights to Spider-Man. So MGM relinquished its claim on the Spider-Man series, And so they sold the rights to Sony for $10 million. So now MGM has Casino Royale, Sony has Spider-Man, and they're both able to proceed with their own versions of those. So this left basically McClory with nowhere to go. He was completely frozen out at this stage because the Thunderball scripts are useless without the Casino Royale situation at Sony. He, at this stage, announced that a film, Warhead 2001, would be made and would be produced in Australia.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But in March 2000, the judge ruled that Kevin McClory had left it too long to claim his co-creation case and that he had been awarded the rights to Thunderball in 1963 and that he should have, if he thought he was the co-creator of Bond, he should have acted on it before then. So that case was then thrown out. And that is pretty much the end of Kevin McClory's battle with Eon to make James Bond films.
Yeah, so he died in November 2006. He was 82. He died in Dublin. And that meant when he died, the rights to Thunderball, the character Blofeld, and Spectre were passed on to his estate. So then 7 years later, November 15th, 2013, the family of Kevin McClory finally agree to sell the rights to MGM and Dan Jack. Were you able to find a figure? Because it's a big, substantial figure, isn't it?
No, I don't know, but I reckon it's probably in the tens of millions.
It's got to be, hasn't it? It's going to be, yeah.
But who would have paid that money? Like, would it have been... would Eon have paid that? Would MGM have paid that? Who knows?
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it, to know where that came from. But this meant that the agreement put an end to all of this, that rivalry that had been going on for five decades, and it meant that 2015 Spectre could be made.
Oh, shame.
And it's the Blofeld stuff, isn't it? And the use of the name Spectre that is the it opens the door for, doesn't it? And with how that worked out. We'll talk about later, but yeah, I mean, it's quite an amazing story, really, and how
it's a ridiculous story.
Yeah, how it affected Bond or the Bond films over those 54 years. There's so many ways, and if you think, like, if it hadn't been hanging over it, like, what would have changed?
Well, my big thing is, if Eon would have had Blofeld and Spectre, it might not have survived had they have just kept using it throughout the Roger Moore years.
Yeah. Might have been really boring. Might have been like just a consistent, boring story that they keep going back to the same thing.
Because they had to come up with new villains.
Yeah, so McClory's probably helped them out along the way.
Yeah.
Especially with the Daniel Craig stuff. The Starks, you know, Royale not having access to Spectre, it probably plays from it. I always think that they went a bit... As soon as they got the rights, they started thinking, right, got to get Spectre in a film, got to do a film about Spectre. They should have held off and just done Spectre properly.
Yeah.
Always annoys me they got so excited by it. Quick, do Spectre. But we haven't mentioned Spectre in two films. Get him in.
it really was the undoing of the Daniel Craig era, I think.
Yeah.
And like I totally agree with you, Brendan. I think the fact that they couldn't use Blofeld throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s just opened the door for reinvention, didn't it? It was moving away from that idea of Spectre and Blofeld. Because
I think ridiculous in the Roger Moore era as well. It would have been an awful depiction of Blofeld.
Yeah.
It would have been that guy in the wheelchair all the time.
Yeah. I mean, we do get some interesting Blofeld likes, don't we, in the Roger Moore era. You've got Stromberg and Drax almost to a certain extent, but... Yeah, I also think the way that, because interesting that it affected how Blofeld was used before Thunderball as well, because there was obviously a big question mark hanging over Thunderball and how he's included, and that's why you get the shadowy version of Blofeld, don't you? And it's never referenced as Blofeld.
The best version of Blofeld.
Yeah, the best version from Russia with Love version, I think.
Yeah.
So and then obviously it then affected the making of Thunderball itself. And that became a film which was, you know, a big hit, but had a lot of behind-the-scenes problems. And then And then obviously you've got how it affects Never Say Never Again and how that becomes such a key battleground in the war between Sean Connery's battle with Cubby.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mad. I always just think McClory was clearly a man who had a lot of an amazing ability to sort of get these things funded and get the right people involved with them. Think what he could have achieved if he'd just gone, right, okay, I'm going to leave that. I'm going to work on something good. He could have made an amazing film series, but it's just strange. Psychologically, it's a very strange obsession.
It's actually a really quite a sad story to waste that much of your life on something, be so fixated on one thing. Because like you say, he was an intelligent man that, you know, had ideas, and, you know.
He could have taken anything and turned it into, you know, a different Bond, a new one. He could have had like a Harry Palmer series or something like that that did really well. He had the means, he had the facilities to do it well.
Flashman.
Oh, God, imagine.
Yeah.
That would have been perfect.
But there's other characters out there. It's so odd that he focused on it. It was fixated. That something must have happened with him and Fleming. Something really affected him, you know, clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting that actually McClory and Cubby remained quite good friends through a lot of all of this time. And isn't Cubby the godfather to one of McClory's kids, I think? So there was some like friendly rivalry at the heart of it, but I think it just went on for so long that it just became such bad blood between them. Mm. And the thing is, it's like when you're obviously we're talking about Never Say Never Again here, and that's like the ultimate outcome of this situation. But when you look at the film, was it worth it? Was it worth all the legal?
Well, that's what I always think about this. There was. Out of all the stuff that McClory did, there was no, even if they did well, there was no good outcome at that point. Like, it wasn't suddenly going to go, the Eon films are crap, we're going to, like, McClory's the one to watch. It just wasn't going to happen, was it? It was such a shot in the dark to go, right, I'm going to make these films and they're going to be bigger and better than the Eon ones. It's just, imagine like somebody trying to make a Harry Potter film now. Yeah. And compete with the other Harry Potter films. It just wouldn't happen.
But the other thing is that he had such a limited... The rights that he had were so limited, he could only tread on that, you know, that storyline. If he started to go in other angles, Eon had the rights for that. So it's like, well, you just...
Yeah, it must be a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are we going to set it in the desert? No, it's got to be underwater. Okay, right.
I think there are other parts of Thunderball they could have explored. I think the origins of Blofeld could have been more explored as could be claimed to be part of the original Thunderball scripts. So I think there might have been other ways of doing it, but it's just sad that in the end it took his death for his family then to benefit from what they had possession of. You know, he could have sold them to Eon, and whether they would have bought them for as much when he was alive, but at least he would have been able to benefit from it. But in fact, all he had was just this legal case that was backwards and forwards and announcing Warhead, Warhead 2000, Warhead 2001. Just like, geez, it's such a sad situation. I just want to thank AJ Chowdhury, the author of the book, Some Kind of Hero, who I spoke to at length about Never Say Never Again and gave me some really good pointers in terms of the time frame of this all and how it worked. But it is a completely unique story. And I was trying to think of if there are any other examples in pop culture where you've got these sort of bifurcated rights to the same IP. And the only thing I could come up with that was close is how you've got Quicksilver in Age of Ultron and in X-Men.
Very, very similar.
Do you know what I mean, though? You've got rights to make the same character.
Yeah, there's probably a load of crossovers in Marvel, isn't there? You've got loads of issues with
Hulk?
Character
usage. What about Hulk?
And stuff like that.
Yes, that was another Hulk, one I was thinking of. Because the solo films, Marvel can't make solo films for the Hulk, can they?
No.
Spider-Man?
Yeah. Spider-Man is a similar-ish sort of situation, isn't it? But they came to an agreement.
Yeah, but there's nothing that spans the whole legacy of a franchise that's been going for 40 years.
No. I wonder if the Spider-Man situation will ever resolve itself in a meaningful way. Probably not.
Doesn't seem like there's any reason for that to happen for either side. They're both... Yeah. It's not really a legal battle, is it? It's more like just... a discussion on how to use him.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get many three-word reviews for it, but then, to be fair, I didn't put the call out for the three-word reviews long before we started recording. But a good one I got from Adrian Hurley was James Bond Senior.
Yes.
Yeah, like that.
Yes. And yeah. Berend Quant said, beats Austin Powers. So, I mean, I don't know if I agree with that. But where do you guys rank it? I know that I asked you to send your rankings over beforehand, but Brendan, yours was quite high, I thought.
Did you? But what did I put it above?
Goldfinger.
Yeah. Brendan, you ranked it. So we've done 14 James Bond films now, and you ranked it at number 9 in the 14 Bond films, above For Your Eyes Only, A View to a Kill.
You're a perplexing man, aren't you?
What's that?
He's a perplexing man.
Yeah. He just doesn't like Roger Moore, does he? Above A View to a Kill, above Diamonds Are Forever, above Moonraker, and above, of course, Casino Royale. Wheatley, you listed it. You said you put it at number 10, above Moonraker, License to Kill, and Die Another Day, and Casino Royale 67. You're completely wrong about License to Kill, but that's the beauty of these things. And me...
Come on, edge of my seat here.
Edge of your seat, yeah. I put it second to bottom. I'm really sorry. I love.
Wow.
I do like Never Say Never Again, but for me, it just doesn't have what I need from a Bond film.
Oh, we have an Eon fanboy.
Yeah.
Ah, oh, well.
I like Sean Connery in it, and I do like seeing Sean Connery as James Bond, but it just doesn't live up to everything else. I like the John Barry music. I like the title sequences. I like all those elements, and this just doesn't have everything.
The reason I put it where I did is because I think that the films that are below it, Moonraker, Die Another Day, License to Kill, I think those films have so much... the ability to be good. Like, they had so much that they could use that would make those films good, but they messed it up and they made bad films. Never Say Never Again didn't have any of that stuff, and I think it pulls it off better than those films. That those films really annoy me because of that. So I could sort of give Never Say Never Again a bit of credit because they didn't have the means that those films did.
That's a good argument, I think. That's interesting. I just don't think it's an interesting way of looking at it. Anyway, in terms of the official rankings, it doesn't, Never Say Never Again doesn't trouble the top. And so our top 10 at the moment is Goldfinger at number 1, From Russia With Love, GoldenEye, Casino Royale, Dr. No, Live and Let Die, License to Kill, For Your Eyes Only, A View to a Kill, Diamonds Are Forever, and Die Another Day at number 11. 12 is Moonraker, and number 13 is Never Say Never Again. And bottom, obviously, still bottom, Casino Royale 1967. But what is really interesting is that Diamonds Are Forever, Die Another Day, Moonraker, and Never Say Never Again, they're actually all on equal footing in the ranking, in the way that we do the weighted score. So it's clear that there is a low, that's our low tier, and they're all sort of within that realm. Diamonds Are Forever, Die Another Day, Moonraker, and Never Say Never Again.
God, that'd be a fun afternoon.
What, watching those for?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure it would be. But yeah, so that's the ranking. And I guess that just about wraps up the Never Say Never Again episode.
Can we please say never again?
Never.
Never. Never again. I'm not going to watch that again.
And you're also not going to be back on the podcast again?
No. So, well, never say never.
You're a very busy man. I appreciate that you've managed to do for so long, to be honest. So the podcast will remain the same, just without Mr. Tom Wheatley. So
you're probably going to be quite happy with that, with the rankings. Imagine next week you'll just whack License to Kill up a few.
Yeah, I don't know what we'll do about the rankings. We'll have to talk about that, Brendan, but
I'll still send mine in.
Yeah. Okay, but yeah, thanks for all your hard work over the last, 18 months or so. You will be missed. Hopefully we'll be able to tempt you back for more podcasts in the future.
Which ones have we got? There's got to be a film that I really want to do.
Well, I thought you'd come back for Spy Love Me, but you're away, aren't you? So,
Quantum.
I'd probably rather do an awful one.
Quantum
of Solace.
Done. Do Quantum. Nice. Yeah, I'll be up for Quantum.
Yeah, I mean, upcoming episodes we've got, next will be No Time to Die, and then we've got Octopussy, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Quantum of Solace, and then, like, that's further down the line, Skyfall, Spectre, Living Daylights, and all the T's. That's going to be a hell of a run, Brendan.
Well, I'll definitely be back for Zed.
Yes.
Zorin.
Come back for Max.
Zorin, yeah.
Yeah.
Just Zorin. 2 hours on Zorin.
But yeah, if people want to email the show and say thank you to Mr. Wheatley, how do they get a hold of us?
Podcast at jamesbondsa2z.co.uk.
And if they want to get us on social media, Brendan?
At jamesbondsa2z on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.
And thanks to everyone who's supported us on Ko-fi so far. Our Ko-fi page is at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA2Z, where you can support the show by buying us a coffee for less than the price of a beer, £3. You can do that as a one-off or recurring payment, which people are doing now. So we really appreciate that. It helps us to keep the podcast going. Means that we will be able to give Mr. Wheatley a nice send-off. And yeah, any final parting words, Wheatley? Any words of wisdom that you want to share with the world?
On Bond or just in general?
I mean, either.
Just check out James Bond Jr. when you get a chance. Some great stuff there. Some great stuff.
We'll bring you back for
just interested to see where you rank it.
Yeah. Without further ado, then, it just remains to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week, but Mr. Wheatley won't.
But Mr. Wheatley may return.
Tease.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Good to see you, Mr. Bond. Things have been awfully dull round here. Bureaucrats running the old place, everything done by the book. Can't make a decision unless the computer gives you the go-ahead. Now you're on this. I hope we're going to have some gratuitous sex and violence.
I certainly hope so too.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.